Good morning. My name is Allison Lionheart. I'm originally from Des Moines, Iowa, and I'm here teaching about the basics of ecofeminist theology. And so probably one of my favorite, I get a lot of different reactions when I say the words ecofeminist theology, and one of my favorite reactions has been, well, that's a mouthful. And so that's why this session is titled, That's a Mouthful. So since we're a smallish group, what I'd like to do is for each of us to perhaps introduce ourselves, maybe say where we're from, and say either a question we have about ecofeminist theology or maybe what we hope to get out of the discussion today. So I guess we can start here and move this way.
Okay, I'm Shirley Campbell-Fritz, and I live in Linwood, Washington. And I need all the help I can get, so I hope to learn a lot.
Okay.
And I'm Judy Thiel from Redmond, Washington, and I have no clue what this is going to be about.
And I'm Susan Evans, and I'm from Seattle, Washington, and my church has done some work on eco-theology, so I'm interested to hear how you put the feminist spin on it.
I'm Phil Strom. I'm from Northfield, Minnesota, and I'm a Candler grad, so yes. It was kind of interesting to see that Allison's from Candler. I'm not familiar with the term ecofeminism theology. I'd like to see how that fits in the broader picture of theology for our world today.
Thank you. I'm Joan Willem, and I guess curious about how ecofeminism. I have aspects of those words separately. I don't know them together, so I'm curious.
Gotcha.
I'm Nancy Carroll from Dubuque, Iowa, and I think you summed up my interest in this topic, which is that I don't know very much. I'm somewhat familiar with feminist point of views and with the whole idea of ecology and conservation and that type of thing. I grew up in the Appalachian Mountains, so that's always kind of been a part of my heritage. So to come to a place like this and have a chance to explore this particular topic is going to be interesting. I'm looking forward to it.
I'm Roy Carroll, also from Dubuque. My curiosity about your topic is that for the last 25, 30 years, I've rubbed shoulders as cantor with theologians at Wartburg Seminary. And there are several there that are very much engaged with the whole feminist theology piece and also creation, care for creation. But I've never really had time to be in those classes and absorb and listen and do the kind of reading. So I'm hoping that this will open some doors for that in our time together.
My name is Karen Dale. I'm from hometown is Portland. I still identify as living on Vashon Island, Washington. I've always been annoyed at the backseat that females and the feminine and females have had to take in our culture, and that includes sometimes in my own heart. So I'm looking to see how the feminine will be honored today.
I'm Kate. From here today. I'm just curious. That's all.
I'm Jonah. I'm also from here. I really like learning about all kinds of things. And I'm particularly, I have more exposure to creation care and the ecology side of it, and would really be curious to see how the feminism piece of it fits into that and kind of how the two influence one another.
Okay. Kelly, also from here right now. I've heard of ecofeminism, I've heard of like creation care, but I haven't seen those kind of both fall into the umbrella of theology.
Gotcha. All right, so ecofeminist. Okay, so Karen, right? You mentioned how women have sort of taken a back seat. And for a lot of history, environmental rights and respecting the earth has also taken a back seat, especially in like European Western philosophies. And so ecofeminism, just on its own, is, according to Wikipedia, a branch of feminism that sees environmentalism and the relationship between women and nature as foundational for its analysis and practice. Okay, so it's looking at the world from these two lenses, how they're related, and how we can improve or empower both of these. And so the theology bit comes in with where is God in all of this? So it kind of relates to creation care a little bit, and then ecofeminist theology really came out of feminist theology. And sort of, we have this holy text that's steeped in patriarchy. So what do we as women do about that, and how do we reconcile that with our faith if we're to be faithful people? And then also, how do we treat the earth well and ourselves well as faithful people? Do I have everyone so far? Okay. And so to give you another definition, real quick, Heather Eaton describes ecofeminism is broadly presented is a convergence of the ecological and feminist analysis and movements. It represents varieties of theoretical, practical, and critical efforts to understand and resist the interrelated dominations of women in nature. So it really is, the best analogy I found for it is a roundabout. So there's a lot of different things coming in, swirling around, leading. And so if at the end of today you're kind of like, you're still not sure what's going on, that's okay, because it's a big topic. And so, yeah, it really is, it's a roundabout. Things are coming in and coming out. And so sort of the history of the field came about in sort of the 1960s and 70s when the environmental movement was starting during that time, and also when the feminist movement was starting. And so it wasn't long before people started to merge those two together. And so another big thing in ecofeminist theology is looking at these themes of domination. And so what, in again, particularly European Western society, has been dominated? It's been the earth, and it's been women. And again, how do we as faithful people counteract that logic of domination? And so, to give some examples of how women and the earth have been connected, or how society has continued to view them together. Historically, as we know, women have been in charge of kind of keeping the home fires burning. You know, they cook, they clean, you know, they make sure everyone like stays alive in the household, basically. And so they're more intimately connected with the life and death cycles that people go through. As well, nature has cycles. There's the seasons. If you're gardening or farming, there's the planting and harvesting season. It's sort of a cyclical nature, again, intimately connected with life and death, and you know, things dying off in the fall, being reborn in the spring, that sort of thing. And so you also have another connection between ecology and feminism is, or women in particular, is women's value being, or women's labor being undervalued. So women being paid less, more domestic chores not being viewed as like worthy of payment, or like as worthy as going outside the home and working. And also the earth and what the earth provides, that is totally undervalued. Like, it's hard to put a monetary sum on what the earth does, but like trees keep the air clean, water is filtered if we don't pollute it, you know, basic stuff that again keeps us alive. And so And then another connection is, again, this sort of logic of domination. And so sort of how the earth has been like clear-cutted and poached and all that stuff, so has there been a lot of sexual assault and violence against women's bodies and who they are. And we kind of see the connection between the two and how they're both just seen as this thing to be used to promote like a capitalist agenda. And so both of these two connections can, I think, can be really summed up into the term Mother Nature. Like, that's a great example of how we have connected women and the earth, like, in our society. And so what's interesting about this term Mother Nature is nature is seen as this sustaining life force. Again, something that, you know, we plant seeds into the ground to get our food. If you eat meat, you have to hunt it, and that all comes from nature. And so on one hand, it's seen as this, Mother Nature is seen as this really positive thing. And on the other hand, the wilderness and Mother Nature can be seen as this really fearful and terrifying thing, so something you need to control. So, for example, in the U.S., when settlers were moving west, I'm from the Midwest, and they, a lot of the predatory animals, people tried to kill off as many as possible because they were trying to control nature and control how they interacted with nature. So, like the bobcats in Iowa were all killed off, and so they're just slowly starting to come back now. I personally feel kind of ambivalent about, because again, yes, they are scary, but like just that sort of mindset again of we need to eradicate this. And another example is in the Adirondacks of upstate New York, they killed off all the moose that was in that area because they viewed them as dangerous, I suppose. So again, you have, yeah.
They are dangerous.
Yeah, they are dangerous.
They're stupid.
Yeah, it's almost scarier sometimes to run into a moose than a bear on trail. Yeah, which is interesting. But so you can sort of see this shift from Mother Nature as something sustaining to something that needs to be, that's wild and needs to be controlled with this sort of, again, domination, and we need to, this industrialization view that started to happen around the 1800s when the U.S. was starting to push westward. And then you also see that with how we treat women as something that needs to be controlled in a certain box, not allowed to be too outspoken, etc. All right? And so, again, what does theology have to do with all of this? Well, this is, again, how do we respond to these things as people of faith? And how do we reconcile Bible verses like Genesis 1, 28 through 30, that talks about having dominion over the earth that many people have interpreted as just doing whatever you want with the earth? Or things like Ephesians 5, 22 and 24 that talks about wives submitting to their husbands. Again, how do you reconcile this holy text with not wanting to plow over women in nature? And so I'm going to pause here and go over some definitions that may be kind of helpful in framing how we look at this. And so the first one is the logic of domination. I've mentioned this a couple times before. It's again, particularly this European Western industrial view of there's a hierarchy of things, so, and the ones that are less or lower on the totem pole are the ones that are going to be dominated, and that's how society functions. Does that make sense for everyone, that definition? And so another one. Anthropocentrism. Big word, sounds intimidating. It's not, it's just means a framework of thinking that's centered, that assumes that humans are superior in the earth. And so assumes that humans are, again, should follow along with this logic of domination. And in a similar vein, we have androcentrism. Which is like anthropocentrism, but it assumes a male view of males are the ones that are dominating the space, and it's a male-centered framework. And then, just throw in here, patriarchy, I believe it's Latin, if it's not, you can correct me, for rule of the father. And that ties in with this androcentrism of males are in charge, a male-centered framework. So let me get. So we have, again, all of these connections have prompted the field of ecofeminist theology. And that, again, was a field that started to come out of the feminist movement and along with the ecological movement that happened in the 1960s. And 70s in the U.S. So now that we've gone over some definitions, I'm going to give us five different ways that ecofeminist theology can be engaged. So five different ways you can sort of plug into this large roundabout, like different lanes, you could say, in which you could enter the roundabout. So. The first one is the whole and the parts. And so the whole is sort of looking at the roundabout as a whole and what's this whole system we're looking at. So a lot of what we're talking about today would be looking at the whole of ecofeminist theology, sort of looking at the foundation of the house and not the individual rooms. And so, and then the parts would be breaking ecofeminist theology down into the different parts. So what is, so that's kind of later this week, we're going to look at what's the more feminist side of ecofeminist theology, what's the ecological side of it, how do people of different races respond to this, that sort of thing. So again, looking more at the individual rooms, not the foundation, the individual lanes, not the full roundabout. And so there's advantages and disadvantages to both. It's easy to get overwhelmed when you're looking at the full thing, but here you gotta make sure not to lose the forest through the trees. So they kind of balance each other. And you know, like anything, you wanna be detailed, but you also wanna look at the full system. So the second way you can sort of approach ecofeminist theology is from a biblical studies perspective. So there's sort of a two-step approach to anything with biblical studies. The first step is looking at how and why the text was written. So even though people have biases, and so they normally have like something they're trying to convey when they write something down. And so understanding that the biblical text also has something that they're trying to convey, and it was written for a certain audience. And oftentimes the Bible was written by people in power, and so how do you interpret that something that was written by and for people in power to people who are not in power, and the different ways you have to interpret it there. And so once you understand how and why the text was written the way it was, then you can start the reinterpretation process of, okay, if I'm not in that position of power, or I'm trying not to fall into this dominating position of power. How do I reinterpret it? And so for ecofeminist theology, some things that are being reinterpreted include the biblical year of Jubilee in Leviticus, which you can tell me what that is. Mm. So we have a refresher, yes.
It's to total rest.
Yes.
The land has to rest, the people have to rest. Everybody takes a whole year off just to rest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Forgiveness of debt.
Yes, mm-hmm. as well. Yeah.
Land is returned.
Mm-hmm. Indentured servants are set free.
Yeah. Yeah, it's sort of a resetting and resting of society that is supposed to happen every 50 years. Obviously, the Israelites did not follow that. But what can we learn from the fact that this was written about in law, about letting land rest, letting people rest, sort of a resetting of society? And so another reinterpretation could be looking at the Sophia character in the Bible, or woman wisdom. Has anyone heard of that? I would like to get. We'll start. We'll go you two, and then you.
It's talked about to a degree in Proverbs, mm-hmm. with like Sophia, the wisdom, as like a co-creator with God.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, what does it mean if we have this more feminine imagery as a co-creator of God, and how does that change our outlook of creation? So. Did either of you two have anything to add? Okay, sounds good. And then a third example is looking at covenant, and a lot of, like, when after the flood, God made a covenant with Noah and his family, he also made a covenant with the earth. And so what does it mean that the earth is part of God's covenant, and then how do we treat the earth as part of the covenant? Sense.
Just so, as an aside,
yeah.
Provost at the college where I taught had to defend a number of things in terms of faculty development and support and encouragement. What swayed her argument in front of the Board of Regents one time was to cite sabbatical as an extension of the idea of the year of Jubilee,
mm-hmm.
that every 7 years you unhooked from being on all the time. I don't know quite how she did it, but they bought it, and we got to keep sabbaticals. They weren't always funded, but we kept the pattern, and that became the expectation. Mm. The devil was in the details, of course, but the expectation was there. And she was the one who sold that.
Yeah.
It's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It was promoting the idea of excising it.
Right here.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah, so that is a perfect example of a, you could call it, ecofeminist interpretation on sabbaticals in an academic setting, and this logic of domination. No, we want to keep making money and continuing to grow. That was kind of against that thought. So.
Yeah, that provost, by the way, was Cheryl Jacobson, who might have been at Wartburg College when you were there. She came from Wartburg College to Loras when I taught.
Hmm.
I'm just thinking these circles, you know, keep
yeah.
we keep running over each other.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, thank you.
Yeah. And so a third way to sort of plug into ecofeminist theology is liberation theology. So who's heard of liberation theology? All right, we're going to start with you back there. If you could give us what you understand to be liberation theology.
It was born in Central America out of the Roman Catholic tradition of oppressed people culturally, intellectually, spiritually. And the notion that Jesus is always on the side of providing liberation in all of those and more aspects of life. So
mm-hmm.
any group considered themselves oppressed, African Americans, Native Americans, women, gay, lesbian, transgendered folks, all of those are under the umbrella of liberation theology as an oppressed people for whom Jesus is
the answer to overthrowing a dominant culture.
Yeah, that was very well put. Did you have anything to add?
Nothing.
Yeah, exactly. And so, again, yeah, I really plug into liberation theology with ecofeminist theology because I see it as something, again, we're to be as faithful people, and where is Jesus? Is Jesus on the side of the oppressed or no? And how do we reconcile that with this logic of domination? And so to just give us some more background and some names with liberation theology, was started by Cesar Gustavus, I believe, in Latin America. And so again, he approached it from more of an economic standpoint about the poor and lower class in society. And then in America, James Cone really took that on, and he looked at it from more of a race perspective, and who are the least of these in America, the racial minorities. And so he writes about that a lot in The Cross and the Lynching Tree. Small plug for The Cross and the Lynching Tree, great book if y'all haven't read it. Also has some ecofeminist-ish vibes in it, because Jesus was killed on a tree and like the tree was chopped down. It's a little bit of a stretch, but you can make some connections there. And where, like, especially in the 1920s, a lot of Black Americans were hung and lynched on trees. And then how does that change the way you look at the natural world and those sort of things? So that's all in there. And yeah, again, liberation theology, very concerned with the reality, real life, down to earth. Like, God isn't up high in the sky, where is God here and now? Ecofeminist theology really plugs into that. How do we treat the earth and women now that we have this? So a fourth way to plug into ecofeminist theology is a multicultural and multi-religious. Way. And so the multicultural piece is kind of tied to liberation theology in that it looks at different cultures. So like ecofeminist theology for a white woman living in the suburbs of Chicago is going to be different than a woman living in the slums of India. Like, that's going to be different. And so how, again, do you take these ideas and apply them to very different situations and still, as a person of faith, like, respect women and nature in those two different scenarios. And then multi-religious sort of takes ecofeminist theology from the Christian circle and flings the door wide open and, like, invites everyone else in. And so you have ecofeminist theology from Hindu perspectives, a lot of Native American spiritualities can plug into that way, and Jewish, etc., etc. And so there's some good interfaith work to be done with ecofeminist theology from a more multi-religious perspective. And so the fifth way can plug into ecofeminist theology. Eco-feminist spiritualities. And this is looking at a lot of more nature-based religion, goddess figures, more plugs into the multi-religious perspectives, kind of plugs into the pagan movement that's going on. And as a way to, again, be a faithful person while also respecting women and the earth. And so do I have any questions for any of the definitions we talked about or any of the five different ways that people plug into ecofeminist theology? Any questions, comments?
Yeah, question.
Okay.
Language.
Mm-hmm.
These things we have called words, is both a way to get to this, and sometimes I think erects barriers. I'm thinking of gender pronouns. The difference, for instance, between die Heimat, the homeland, it's feminine article, isn't it? So we could call that die Heimat would be like the motherland,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to der Vaterland.
Mm-hmm.
I once had a German soldier, survivor of being a German soldier, who said, yeah, we were encouraged as young boys to prepare to die for the fatherland. But should we die for the fatherland, we would be buried in the motherland, the homeland.
Oh.
That's lost in English,
mm-hmm.
the mother, the father. But the Germans use that, and I suspect it's probably in other Western European languages. Was that rooted in Latin? You have male pronouns and or articles and female articles. Die Heimat and der Vaterland. So I'm just wondering about how language, which of those categories would one, this what is an alley off of one of the entrances on the roundabout, but
mm-hmm.
it seems to be so crucial when you're thinking about cultural perspectives on
yeah.
any of this.
I would put that
if you were to find a little room off of,
yeah.
which ironically feeds our discussion. I think when we talk about Mother Earth, Father Earth,
mm-hmm.
and God's interaction to me.
So on a small tangent, I once read an article where if the like word for bridge was
yeah.
masculine in one language, they described bridges as like sturdy and industrial,
uh-huh.
whereas if bridge for that language was a feminine word, they describe bridges as like elegant and like graceful. And so yeah, language
there
is
we are.
Yeah, language is a huge, trying to think of where that would fit in here.
Yeah.
Maybe just like blanket over all of it. Because we
yeah.
use language to talk about all of it. But yeah, especially I think language is, you could put language as another small way to approach this. Because,
yeah.
That German example, and again, Mother Nature. How do we speak about nature?
Yeah.
Do we speak about it as something sustaining, something
yeah.
to be controlled?
Right.
How do we speak about women as
yeah.
well?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, these are all lenses, and I would see one that's missing there, and I think it's coming from the sort of ecological and conservation movements of protection of the land from the whole, you know, create parks,
mm-hmm.
save areas from dams or developments. And that has, I'm sure, has got a lot of female participation in it, and that has driven, why do we want to conserve?
Mm-hmm.
Why are our values misplaced? Are our values so dominated by capitalism and a dominance model, a self-defensive humanness model, that we're not allowing for abundant nature to exist in our own right? Anyway, that is certainly, the conservation movement has certainly got to be a stream that circulates around this roundabout.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can include it. Something that's really interesting about the conservation movement, at least in America, is when it was founded, like in 1872 with the founding of Yellowstone, it was like Teddy Roosevelt and John Muir. It was more of a like men wanting to do this, and they like kicked out a lot of the Native Americans from their traditional land in order to create these parks.
Hmm.
But then again, like about a century later in the 1960s, you see the women taking more of a role in the conservation movement with like Rachel Carlson and Silent Spring. And in India, there was a movement not to cut down the trees, and that was led by women. Yeah, it's, I'm not sure what's in there, but it's a complicated way to look. Kind of, yeah, like this was initially sort of a male-driven thing, but then women kind of kept it up.
And that brings in a good point, is that when we think about nature and these big, large themes and where we are in them, it's important to recognize where, like, I'm a woman. And so, like, yes, I could be described as a victim of some of the of this logic of domination, but where do I also perpetuate it? And so for you to kind of look at, where are you negatively impacted by it? Where are you perpetuating it?
Too many children.
And also, where are you rebelling from
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
I was, you know, thinking about the logic of domination, about how it is a social model. But dating back to the time of kings and patriarchs and all that, but we also treasure our stories of outlaws. We treasure our stories of, like, Calamity Jane, Sacagawea, Nellie Bly, the small-grained exceptions. The model keeps sort of cropping up, but how are we the exception? How do we take a chink out of the big pyramid of the logic of domination?
Yeah.
I'm in a synod with a that had a male bishop who I consider to be an ally in eco stuff, in feminist stuff, who was willing to serve another term, and it turned out that a woman was going to be our next bishop. She's wonderful and amazing and has all these great gifts. But I'm feeling myself the animus of a, we needed to have a women bishop. Our region went from, you know, like 3 women and 4 men to 7 women and 1 man as bishop. And it didn't feel healthy recognition of gifts distributed across gender as much as it felt like we're getting that anybody who represents domination out of the picture. And mm-hmm. so a woman is going to replace a white male, period.
Mm-hmm.
A woman of color replacing a white male is even better. And I get the history behind all that. It's just in this particular case, it's like, can't you tell the difference between a white male ally and a white male pig? Yeah. And if you're going to paint them all as pigs, then you're just staying within the logic of domination. You're just mm-hmm. replacing the gender that's imposing it a little bit.
Yeah.
And it took me weeks. I mean, it took me weeks to kind of get okay with this. And I love the woman who we elected as bishop.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not about her as an individual person. It's this, it feels like the anger of history has got so much momentum behind it that eco-feminist, as soon as you put those two words together for me, right now, my sense is angry women working their stuff out, needing to put some blinders around the fact that not all men are pig. Or not all of the historical symbols of oppression and domination are in that space right now. And I thought I was all worked out of that, and it came back with this conversation. Mm-hmm. That there's still more there.
Sure.
Because I would kind of like a world where we could all get along.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Right? You don't have to... we're not all parts. So I guess maybe it's the whole of the parts.
Yes.
Is
yeah.
in the whole of the parts, let's admit that there's, you know, centuries of anger as a part of this. So there's some psychology in the midst of this theology. And I guess until I feel like that's one of the lenses we're using, it feels like we're trying to use our language to sculpt a perfect world that rights all the wrongs of history, which is like not feasible, impossible. And we're blockading some of the participants in the solution because they were lumped with the dominating group, mm-hmm. whether they still behave that way or not.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to note how, like, ecofeminist theology, yeah, can be groundbreaking, but it still is missing a lot of pieces. So it has, where, again, do we still perpetuate this logic of domination within it, and where can we go against it? And, for instance, there is no mention of, like, LGBTQ individuals in any of this, and so where are they in it? And sort of, yeah, there's the field. Like, what I found in academia is there's the established field, there's what's going happening in society, and it takes, like, academia, like, 15 years to catch up. Which can be frustrating. So, yeah, thanks for bringing that point up of, again, within the whole and the parts, what is this whole system where, what are the parts that still need to be worked on? Where are the streets that are going in the roundabout that maybe need repaved or need some new lines put in? So, yeah. Okay.
It seems to me that at the point we're at right now in terms of creation care, we need to forget about the differences of the parts and combine all forces we possibly can into the whole to take action, to do things, to take care of creation.
Mm-hmm. Kind of mobilize all forces.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. I think.
And one of the things mm-hmm. women can do is stop having so many children.
Mm-hmm.
Amen.
I mean, around the world.
Yeah, I once heard one of the best environmental things you can do is educate women and get them birth control. And I was like, amen to both of those things.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The New York Times put out a large publication of over 100 things we could be doing to in terms of creation care. And about number 4 on the list is population control.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what's interesting along those lines that I find is what are 2 of the most like politically divisive topics right now is women's rights, you know, right to birth control or abortions, and environmental rights. Like, how are we going to restrict like pollution and things like that? And so, yeah, that kind of relates to ecofeminist theology in that way. Like, what are the things we're struggling with right now? It tends to be women and gender and the environment. Yeah. Do you have any other thoughts, comments?
Well, okay. I'm wondering, based on all of the, it's not pushback, but when we put this down into 5 different ways to get into it, it forces us into, or puts us into these smaller lenses. I'm wondering, what is it that you see brings a person to the tipping point to care enough to not dominate birth or women?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And is there one of these lanes that's more effective in bringing the person who's not got who to make the practical decision to make a difference?
It seems like
where's that tipping point? What is it that pushes you? What is it that brings a person to the point of making a difference for good rather than just standing up for what they think is most important to them?
Mm. Were you going to say something?
Yeah, I would think that would depend heavily on the particular person. Like, the answer could be different for anyone depending on their own history or their own biases.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
yeah. So, like, going along that, yeah. So for some, like having their pastor make an ecological stance is going going to be the tipping point to get them to care. Is that what you're asking? And for other people, plugging into liberation theology is going to be the tipping point. Is that, like, you have, like, for anything, like, anything related to kind of social justice care, it normally has to impact you or someone you love personally. And so, I wish...
That puts us in a desperate place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so, like, I wish we could just use these as nice, clean ways to just sort of get people to care, but a lot of the times it's going to have to impact them personally. And so approaching it from that way can, again, complicate the picture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think parents and grandparents are often more inclined to get involved in that because they think about the people they love and how they're going to be impacted in the future by what's going on today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I love national parks and visiting them, so I just think, like, I want this to be around for people coming after me. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I hear people saying again and again, right here, right now, you have to care.
Mm-hmm.
I've moved toward peace and thinking, all right, if there's one of these areas, and I think I have one, where I can be a voice and a model for caring about the whole roundabout, the whole picture, then that's where I want to kind of be, but I want to be informed and shaped by all the other streams that flow into this roundabout, so I don't lose sight of the big picture. I can't carry all of it all the time,
mm-hmm.
but I can be part of the stream. Yeah, somebody asked one of the faculty members at the seminary one day, you know, what's going to change? And it wasn't just about this, it was anything else. He says, when enough of us care about something to find a way to engage with it, then it will change. If we don't find a way to care, it won't.
Yeah.
So in one sense, the lenses that we're looking through have so much to do with, as you said, personal context, and that can be fragmenting, but I think it can also be a way to spur individuals and into smaller groups, into larger groups, and therefore into effective action. I mean, look at the civil rights movement, if you will. So that's kind of how that got started.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you see hesitant steps, we just need to speed up that movement.
Yeah. I think a lot of what we've been mentioning comes back to the whole and the parts and sort of the balancing between looking at the whole roundabout and the individual ways people can engage it. And so, yeah, relating to caring, the Center for Civil and Human Rights that is in Atlanta, where I went to school, they have a t-shirt a lot of my classmates wore that just said, give a damn on it. So a lot of us have to give a damn in order to enact change. So you're free to curse with that one. Here. It's a big challenge, and it's a big field. So yeah, a lot of things to chew on here.
Just kind of a general question. Do you find the term ecofeminism, as you've been out and speaking to people and doing your research and so on, do you find that that's a welcoming term, or one that, especially for someone who's maybe 60 and older, is that a bit of a, wait a minute, what am I getting into type reaction?
A mouthful.
It depends.
Yeah,
because I had this book, Introducing Ecofeminist Theologies, with me in church, and I had an older woman come up, and she's like, oh, that's great that you're reading that book. I wish they would have something like that here. And then I also had a woman at the service last night going, that sounds like something I know nothing about. And I was like, okay. Like, it really just depends. So, I'm trying to think if there's, like, groups of people that react more to it than others, and it really just depends. Because you throw feminist in there, and it just There is no, there's no clear cut. Look at that.
Well, I like your question because I want folks to care.
Yeah.
I want there to be buy-in. Mm. You know, we need more people to buy in. Mm. But personally, ecofeminist,
mm-hmm.
I'm not buying in.
Mm-hmm.
It's too narrow. It's too flag waving for something that now I care about and you should care.
Mm.
It's it doesn't embrace
you don't.
Me. So that's
you don't. So I mean, I just as an example.
Yeah.
I mean,
so
you know,
I think it's a great question.
Like you.
In terms of the larger topic of how does the general population
again that's right
get a sensitivity to caring or wanting to make a difference.
The context is and as you have said very well this morning, it's just so important. I mentioned I grew up in the Appalachians in Western Virginia. If you were to even be invited to just about anywhere in the state of West Virginia, you'd find individuals there who I might not agree with on either with their theology or their lifestyle and so on. Coal miners, for instance. They care very deeply about where they live,
mm-hmm.
what it looks like, how it affects their families, but by golly, given the opportunity, they'll be down in that mine 6 days a week,
mm-hmm.
regardless of what it does to the environment,
mm-hmm.
because they have to take care
mm-hmm.
of their family, and the whole providing for what I know in the lens and context of what I know, just, it trumps everything. But you are starting to see you're starting to see some pushback
mm-hmm.
with that, especially when a company comes in, just completely, you know, blows the top off the mountains, pollutes their water, and then declares bankruptcy so they don't have to pay for black lung disease
mm-hmm.
treatment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're starting to look at it differently. It's really hard when you and your preceding generations for 250 years, that's all you've known.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a little dangerous to say they don't care.
Mm-hmm.
They do care. It's just a matter of, as you said, refocusing.
Yeah, reframing.
Reframing it.
Yeah. And for, like you were saying, some people may be like, I don't want to approach that. At least for me, I'm a younger person trying to like make a way in this world, and for me, I'm like, I'm gonna make a stand on it, and you can like it whether or not. Like, but I think
yeah.
like that had to come with a lot of these movements, like the civil rights movement, the feminist movement. In the 60s, they had to be like, we're gonna make this stand,
yeah.
and some people are gonna be approachable to,
yeah.
or some people are gonna approach it, and some people aren't. And so, I hesitate to water it down, so to speak, to make it approachable to everyone, because then I think it loses the point of why it's there. But I think definitely that's why there are these different ways to approach it, is to perhaps get different people to engage in different ways.
So as an example, perhaps, of that, using language, the hymn writer Brian Wren was invited by the United Methodist Church to create a new hymn text that would speak to the large human family, and our images of God. His first stanza was, Strong Mother God.
Mm.
That was submitted to the appropriate board within the United Methodist Church, and back came a very gracious letter. Thank you, Brian, for this lovely new hymn, but we don't think we can use that as the first stanza. His response was, I get it, you're right. The first stanza will begin, Bring many names.
Mm.
And then, as you dug into the body of the text, Mother God is there, so is Father God, old aging God, young impatient God.
Mm-hmm.
They're all there. But it was that front-end encounter that, in this case, the United Methodist Hymnal Board said, thank you very much, and it goes.
Yeah.
And he didn't see that, by the way, as watering down, but rather as a more pastoral opening way of getting your attention. Now let's explore how we name God, and what does that say?
Yeah.
That's where he went with it. Oh, that's very interesting. That might be a reframing, one that worked.
Yeah, I think it's situation by situation.
Yep, absolutely.
For sure. Sometimes you need to be more bold, and sometimes you need to
yes.
tweak it.
One of the topics before the five lanes of entry, the logic of domination, you know, figures into the miner's mindset, mm-hmm. and to my mindset, and to the hymn writer's mindset,
yeah.
and to have a way to even walk or explore how am I part of that whole picture of domination in this regard, or whether I suffer because of it, or if I perpetuate it.
Yeah.
It's very intriguing. And the five lanes are filled with people who would love to dominate others with their particular bent or lens. That's the thing.
Yeah. Again, where are you negatively impacted by this? Where are you perpetuating it? Yeah. And
do you give a damn?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. What's something interesting about the coal miners is I'm looking to hope. I have a job in Breckenridge, Colorado for the upcoming winter, and that used to be a mining town. A lot of the towns in Colorado used to be mining towns.
Mm-hmm.
And then they found tourism. And they just replaced mining with tourism and like having an ecological bent on tourism. And so, yeah, I find it interesting that, well, West Virginia doesn't have like these sexy ski slopes. And so like they keep mining them. They don't like have tourism. Yeah, it's really...
Well, they are moving that way, and they want that to happen.
How ironic then that climate change is messing with that.
Yeah.
I just was going to say, if you're going to reframe something, you have to give people the opportunity to find ways
mm-hmm.
to reframe it.
Thinking of
the coal miners, they do that because they don't know how to do anything different.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been hearing and reading about people who are coming to some of these coal mining communities and beginning to do things relating to technology
mm-hmm.
so that coal miners have
a training, re-education, more education,
mm-hmm.
and then providing the opportunity to use what they learned
mm-hmm.
in support, so on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So definitely this reframing can kind of fit into this reformation that Holden is talking about. So kind of reframing, reformation about how we think about the earth, women, who are we as faithful people to approach those two things. I don't know the correct word for that, but those two things we have to deal with. Okay, and so I'm going to end this off by, again, part of eco-feminist theology is you have kind of this orthodoxy, and that should lead to orthopraxy. So for them, it's orthodoxy, more right belief, and then orthopraxy, right practice. So here we've been talking about a lot of ideas and kind of musing about different things. And so I'm going to end each session with a sort of call to action or a question to further ponder. And so we can kind of relate again, okay, these are really interesting ideas, but what do they have to do with our real life? And so today's call to action comes from The Blue Sapphire of the Mind by Douglas E. Christie. He actually does he does queer theology and queer eco-theology, so if you think this is crazy, you should read some of his work. It's even more crazy. But in this, he talks a lot about how the connection of how we talk about the natural world and the connection that has with how we talk about the sacred
or the divine. And he frames it as through poetry and how poets have to sit and they notice things in the world and then they kind of notice patterns in those cycles and then they write about them in their poetry. And so he has this real concentration on just noticing and contemplation, especially in the outdoors. And then he says he has, again, another connection between prayer and work. So these poets sit and they look at things and they contemplate them and then they get to work and they write poetry. Or he was talking about monastic communities. They sit and they pray and then they work and they sustain themselves. So again, this connection between thinking and like real life application. And so my call to action today is to maybe just take a small moment, maybe 5-10 minutes today, and to just sit and notice something, maybe a plant or the ridge of the mountain line or something like that, and just kind of sit with it and sort of sit with God in that moment and think about what we've talked about today, and your experiences at Holden Village, and how that can influence your life outside of the village. So, thank you for joining me today. Hope you all have a good rest of your day. To close us out, I'm going to read a Mary Oliver poem. So if you were at breakfast, you get 2 Mary Oliver poems today, so it's a good day.
That's right.
Yeah, and this will close us out. It's Wild Geese. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over and over again, announcing your place in the family of things. Amen. Mm-hmm. Again, thanks for joining me. Hope you all have a good rest of your day.
Thank you.